We probably say, I probably say too often, maybe we say too often, one of our favorite people. But this, it's sincere here because Jim Houston has become a legend in hockey broadcasting, certainly in this country. He has always been cooperative, willing to give his time. Almost every time he flew into Toronto to do a game, he'd always agree to come on, whether it was on the Friday before the game or on the Monday after the game. And Jim Houston has announced that he's retiring from Hockey Night in Canada and from hockey play-by-play. And we're going to spend some time chatting with him. And I don't doubt that Mr. Shannon, he will exchange a few stories since they used to work together.
Well, yeah, it's the industry, the hockey broadcast industry, Bob, is pretty small. And everybody, there's a bunch of people that have crossed paths for, gosh, that, you know, that 40-year number. We've been in this together a long time, and the good thing is that we've remained friends over that time, and there's a bunch of us that have remained friends, and that's the exciting part.
Jim Houston, this time, and we'll be back after these messages. It's McCowan, it's Shannon on the program for this day, and we are, you're chortling. Why are you chortling?
Because I think he should take the smile off his face. He can't be this happy.
He's ecstatic. He's a quitter, but he's ecstatic as a quitter. After 42 years, allegedly, behind a microphone and on camera, Jim Houston has announced his retirement from broadcasting. He joins us from BC, where you're playing golf every day now, Huey. Is that right?
Well, no. And, you know, yesterday I played on the first official day of my retirement from broadcasting. I played golf just to get away from the noise. And about the ninth hole, one of the guys in my foursome said, "You better call Rogers and get your job back because your golf game is crap." if you think you're going to be a good golfer in your retirement, you have some more to think about.
So that's just for the senior tour, yeah?
Jim, that just means the guys you're playing with don't want you on their team when they play for money. That's all.
I know. No, they love play. They love me on their team because I always end up buying the wine.
Well, did you take a traditional route into this business? I mean, did you grow up wanting to be in broadcasting?
Not at all.
So tell me about it. How'd you get into this racket?
So I'll give you the Cole's Notes version, Bob. So I went off to university after high school, wanting to be an actor. That's what I was going to do. I went into the theater department and, I quickly found out that university didn't pay very well. And that there were other people that also wanted to be actors, and it was going to be a difficult route. During high school, I had this job at a radio station in my hometown, Fort St. John, and way up in northern British Columbia, and I quite enjoyed it. So much to the chagrin of my parents, I quit university. I went back to the radio station, and because I could make $400 a month, the life was good. In those days, we took $20 out of the bank on Friday, and that was good for the weekend with money left over. I never had any ambition to do what I ended up doing, but I fell into it because in a small radio station, the sports director, which is a really nice title, was the only person in the sports department. And then that guy left because he got a better job. And I was the only guy left in the radio station that knew a puck from a football. So I became the sports director. Along with the job in the sales department and reading news and doing everything. And I quite liked it. But my ambition then was to leave that town and make a little more money. So I followed the trail of $50 more each month. That was my ambition. So I went to Penticton, I went to Kelowna, I went out to Brandon, Manitoba. I did a number of other things. But what happened along the way was I kept falling into the sports department because I played hockey. I was around hockey. I loved the game. Would love to have played it, but realized that, I was never going to be a professional hockey player. So it just kind of led to that. It sort of led me along. And then when I eventually got an offer for a job in Vancouver and absolutely talked my way into being a play-by-play announcer, and got an opportunity when Jim Robson, who was the play-by-play man for the Vancouver Canucks, started doing Hockey Night in Canada on Saturdays. I filled in for him on the radio. And when I got a chance to do that, I thought, this is a job that I could do for a long time. You know, it's all winter, it's summer's off, it's all, this is what I want to do. And so that, you know, that's the short story of a long journey that got me into this business. And then I ran into guys like Shannon and then other people who dragged me along into different positions that I got, and just kept at it.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that, you know, the press release on Tuesday said that, you know, Jim Houston joined Hockey Night in Canada in 2005. Well, that's wrong. Jim Houston did a playoff game in 1984 in Calgary at the Corral.
At the old Corral. Yeah. With Howie Meeker as my color commentator.
Yeah, so that was it wasn't you know, accuracy in the press release is one thing, but that's okay. So that's how Jim and I met Jim at the Coliseum. He was wearing this is the difference between radio and television in those days. Jim had hair down to his shoulders. He had a Fu Manchu. He had shorts. He had cut off shorts that you could see the bottom of the pockets. And he was the radio guy that day. And I'm wearing a shirt and tie at 10 o'clock in the morning as the producer for Hockey Night in Canada. And we met, and I said, well, if you're filling in for Robson, send me a tape of your play-by-play. And so we did. He did. And we married his radio play-by-play to the video of the same game. I sent it off to my cohorts in Toronto. And really, that was Jim's introduction on the national stage to this guy could do play-by-play for us.
And that video, the audio and video was from 1982, and it was the Vancouver Canucks Stanley Cup run. And in the first round, they played Calgary.
That's right.
And I distinctly remember what I sent off to you on a tape that was about this big, barely not reel to reel. And it was so. Then I had the opportunity to move to Toronto and had just no clue what I was in for and was feeling my way through it, but it seemed to work out.
By the way, so was everybody else, Jim. We just wouldn't admit it. That's all.
Yeah, exactly.
Difference between doing radio play-by-play and TV play-by-play. We think it's dramatically different. Was it for you?
Initially, probably not, because it took me a while to figure out that silence on television was okay. And, you know, there's a lot of guys that still haven't figured that out. So I did initially in my hockey television work, I still did traditional radio play-by-play. And as years went by, I realized that the people who are watching with me could also see it. And I didn't have to talk as much. And it came to the point where one of my people often ask me, Bob, about, your favorite call and that sort of thing. And
yeah.
I find that over the years, what I learned was that sometimes the best call is when you have the good sense to shut the up. Mm-hmm. And in one of my favorite times in all of the time that I've worked in television would have been the second Stanley Cup for the Los Angeles Kings, 2014, they were well ahead in the third period. It was obvious that they were going to win the Stanley Cup and they were going to win it on home ice. There was nothing left to be said. And I went on to the talk back to our director, Ronnie Forsyth, and said, the game is yours with about 3 minutes left. And not another word was spoken until the horn went and the Stanley Cup was presented. Wow. And for me, those are some of my best words.
So, I'm curious. We'll get into why you made this decision, but a little bit later. But when you made the decision, who did you call?
Who did I call? There's some really good friends that I have. My longtime partner, Craig Simpson, has known for a while. that I've been considering this. So I've talked to him about that. Shirelli Najak, who's been the leading producer for Hockey Night in Canada for a long time, and Dave Hodge, who's a really good pal. And quite often we talk more about music and other things than we do about hockey. But and the other person is Jim Robson. And the legendary Jim Robson, who is a very dear, good friend of mine, said to me and gave me some very wise words. He said, if you decide to retire, you are taking the best job you ever have. And taking that to heart, I thought, that's a pretty good way of looking at retirement. It's the best job I'll ever have.
Well, we'll see whether you feel that way
we will.
6 months from now.
Hey, if we're a day in and so far so good.
Well, except your golf partners are bailing on you already. Yeah, so that's all right.
I know.
So my look, we know each other a little bit, just for clarity. We don't know each other all that well. My sense has always been that you have a pretty good memory for things that have happened, things that you've seen. I find that completely foreign, because as Shannon will probably tell you, I can't remember who we had on yesterday.
That's half my job, Jim, is to remind. Hey, remember we had Zokol and Leggett on yesterday? Nope. You know, anyway,
so, and I'm not lying. I literally walked out of the studio for 40 years, and 5 minutes after I left, I had no recollection of anybody I talked to. So, is that a process for you? Is this, do you file things away that you think are going to ultimately be important?
I suppose I do, but not consciously.
No,
it's just what I've done. You know, it's like preparing for a Saturday game or a playoff game or something like that. You spend your week watching games. That's your preparation. It's watching. It's retaining. It's not about, so many people think that the play-by-play job is about memorization, about learning who the players are and what their numbers are. And they always ask, how do you know who all the players are? Well, that's the easiest thing in the world. Everybody can do memorization. Everybody has redundancies in their job on a daily basis that they do without even thinking about it. My retention of things is, okay, how does this team play in the game? And how are they, and why are they winning? And that sort of thing. And just watching, so that, as an old football player once told me, and you know, football players play once a week. This guy said to me one day, you know, if I do my work and I get ready and do my work all week long, the game itself is recreation. Always worked for me too. So you get to Saturday night, if you've done your preparation, if you know what you think you're going to see, or if you're ready for what you might see, then the game is recreation. So in that sense, yes, there is a certain amount of retention, but it's not a conscious memorization of things that I see on a daily basis. It's just what I've done.
What's the difference between doing a single game a week, which you basically have done in the regular season for the last, 15 years?
Yeah.
What's the difference between that and then those years where you were doing 65 to 70 games with the same team or you know, doing 4 games a week?
Yeah, it was very different. I was doing 110 games sometimes. Wow. Because I would do like the local games for the Vancouver Canucks, and then I go off and I do some Sportsnet national games and things like that. The difference is just simply the volume. But in some ways, when you're really busy and immersed in it like that, it's a little bit easier because you never sort of lose a pace. You're going, you know, you're just doing it. The difficulty of that is that every once in a while, if you're doing 4 games in a week, you're going to run into a team that you haven't been able to watch very much. You haven't been able to see as much of them. You know, you're doing one game a week. I would sit at home and spend my days, because I'm in the Pacific time zone, 4 o'clock was sit in the office, it's game time. And I watch at least 2 games a day and see what was going on and try and, you know, see a cross section of the league and figure out what was going on, and especially watch the teams that I knew I was going to see on the weekend. So there's, you know, a wonderful opportunity for preparation. When you're doing a whole bunch of games, there's occasionally you have to wing it. Yeah. Just because, you know, you'll run across a back-to-back where the team that you're seeing on the second night you haven't been able to watch for a while.
This may sound silly, but can you prepare too much?
I suppose you can, because here's the weird thing that happens in hockey. And I suppose this happens, and I do believe this happens in every sport. You think you're absolutely prepared. You've watched the teams that you're going to see on a Saturday night, and you've watched them and watched them and watched them, and you know everything about them, and you know their power plays, you know how they forecheck, you know how they do this and they do that. The puck drops and something happens 30 seconds in that changes the entire night. So you got to wing it. And that's where, and so all the preparation you've done, take it and toss it in the garbage, because now the game is completely different. Somebody gets hurt, they're out of the game. I think about the playoff game. I didn't do it, but I was watching it, how, you know, you start a playoff series and John Tavares gets hurt against Montreal. And all of a sudden that playoff series is completely different than anybody thought it was going to be. So, you know, you have no choice but to improvise. But if you know, if you're prepared enough, you have the knowledge of how things might go, but you're never really sure. And it's the beauty of doing live sports events and the beauty of live hockey games. It's a frenetic sport where it can change. It can change dramatically in a second. And you may not have prepared for that, but I suppose in a sense you have, if you know who might replace whom and what might go on. But it's preparing for live sports is, yeah, it's a crapshoot in some ways, because you're never really sure what's going to happen.
With Jim Houston. So do you, you'll finish a game. Will you have a tape of that game? Will you watch and listen to yourself? Are you self-critical, self-analytical?
Always have been. Yeah. I find it really important for a couple of reasons. No, and not for the reasons that people might think. Like, I'm not listening and you didn't sound good. Your voice wasn't good that night. I'm looking for our show. I'm looking at our show. At the end of the night, at the end of a game, I would always ask, did we tell the story of the game? And I would always listen to coach interviews, player interviews, trying to understand how they thought, or go down and talk to different people about that also watch the game and get their feeling about it. And then watch back and maybe not watch the whole thing, but spot watch it for different spots to see if we properly told the story of how this happened, what happened, where this penalty occurred and why, and was it really a penalty? Just because the game is frenetic and it happens so quickly, and you have to make a judgment when you're calling it and when you're talking about it. And so just to go back and make sure that we did it. And the other thing is to try and pick up redundancy, so to make sure that I wasn't spending a lot of time, using the same crutch words over and over again to try and eliminate some of those things. But yeah, I always think it's important to watch your own work and not leave it behind, because it can help make you better.
Shannon give you a shit on a regular basis when you work with him?
We always talked a lot about the same kind of things. I don't remember you having given me a lot of crap about things.
No, I think when you find a group of people that have the same passion, and we've mentioned one guy already in Dave Hodge that has the same passion, there's a lot more cohesion in our discussions than there would be anything else. There'd be a lot more of, why didn't we do this better? And it wasn't, you screwed up or I screwed up. It was what? Me. Yeah. Because I had this affectation and this belief that we were the third team on the ice. We coached both teams. We needed to know why both teams succeeded. And again, the stuff that Jim said about evaluation after, I didn't watch very much. I just made sure through, what the coaches said. And more importantly, in the next morning, if the newspaper told the story of the game and it was exactly what we talked about during the game with our instant analysis, then we know we did a good job. And that was where I think guys like Jim and I, even when we weren't working together, continually talked about, our craft of doing this job. And, people can laugh about calling it a craft, but, there's a real passion to do it properly. And that came from a few of us doing that. Don't you think, Jim?
Yeah, and what people don't know is that when they watch the game, there's, you know, basically two guys they're watching in most cases, or sometimes three, because it's, you know, that we're just the announcers. But there's this incredible team that works together. And I've been fortunate in the last number of years to work with what I think is the best team that I've ever worked with, the best group of people that I've ever worked with, who are all right from the guy who, you know, who plugged in the camera, to the person who counted backwards to the commercials, to EBS operators, tape operators, director, producer. It's an incredible team.
Yeah.
And so when I worked with Shirelli and Ajak, we would do a debrief on a Tuesday after a Saturday game, and would both have watched a lot of the game. Just talk about just exactly what you were talking about, John. Just say, how do we do here? How do we do this? You know, I'd say, I don't think we handled this particular situation really well. How could we have done that a little better? And yeah, sometimes we disagree on whether we did it well or not, but it was never, you did this, I did that, this person screwed up here. It was always us.
So the interesting thing, and this might be generational. So when I started, there was a giant divide between announcers and production people. A giant divide was the, you know, you saw, I mean, there were guys I worked with I only ever talked to on headset. Never saw them before the game, never saw them after the game. But in my time, starting in the mid 80s and in the 90s, when I was in a TV mobile, I was shocked to turn around and see, well, there's Jim Houston talking to the tape operators, and there's Jim Houston talking to the audio guy. To see a commentator actually in the TV mobile, and then after the game coming by to say thank you, was a revelation for a lot of people. And that's where that goes back to that team effort thing.
So important to me. I think everything is team. I mean, I grew up in team sports, right? So you've got that, it stems from that. And you're only as good as the weakest link on any night that you work. And so I've always, it's truly genuine. Like, I didn't do it just because of the optics. I didn't want to be, you know, be the guy to be seen going through the truck. I love those guys. They were my friends. So I go through the truck and talk to everybody, and we talk about what we might see in the game, or just say hi to everybody, because I know they were working a hell of a lot more than I am. More hours, certainly, and then meet them afterwards and go for a beer and talk about the game or talk about their life and get to know them, so that we could become at least a little bit of a family out on the road when you're out for 2 months of a playoff run. It's pretty important to know those guys and to have people to go out to dinner with that. And it didn't matter whether they were the statistician or they were the EBS operator or the announcer. We were all on the same level on the same team.
By the way, like a player, that might be the part that you're going to miss more than anything.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. And I've said this a couple of times to people who are on that team that I've been on for a while, that's what I'll really miss. I'll just miss the camaraderie, the going to see what Slappy's room looked like after everybody gathered there all night. It was just fabulous to work with a group of people that I can genuinely say you leave with a smile on your face and you love them and you just can't wait to see them again. And so they were able to assemble a group that I think is probably the best hockey production group in the world that worked together for a while. And thanks to what's gone on in our world in the last couple of years, that whole group is coming apart, but it'll be reassembled in a different fashion, and we'll work for another group.
Well, we'll talk about that. Jim Houston is with us. The gentleman formerly known as Jim Houston.
Yes.
Now retired.
There was a guy. So he says. The guy actually wanted me to change my name at one point.
What, to Bill Houston?
Working at the radio.
Bill Houston?
Yeah.
Foster Houston.
They didn't think that Jim Houston was I was in the radio business. They didn't think that Jim Houston was kind of a sexy enough name to sell. And I just looked at him and said, "Are you kidding me? No, that is not going to happen." So anyway, pardon me for interrupting.
Not at all. There, the world is filled with would-be broadcasters who tell broadcasters what they should and shouldn't do.
Yeah.
With a quick break, and then Jim Houston returns after these messages. After 42 years behind a microphone and in front of a camera, Jim Houston has retired.
Wait, we haven't asked the one question yet, though, Bob.
Well, we're getting to it.
Okay, go. It's only why? One word. Yeah, why? That's right.
I don't want to be too long, convoluted, and too complicated about it, but
no, be as long as you want.
You know, excuse me. I've lost my voice. That's why I'm leaving. There were a few things that went into it, but it's a confluence of a number of things that come together. One of which that when you do this job, when you take it seriously and you go to work the way I have in the past, you're away forever. You miss everything. My wife Denise was there for every parent-teacher meeting, every minor hockey game, every dance recital, all the stuff that I missed. And so there comes a time when it's a tiny little payback, but there's some of that involved, and you know, it's time. And as much as I loved the game and loved being at the games, the travel started to wear on me, and leaving home at the 1st of April and missing the entire spring because you don't get home until the 20th of June, as exciting as all those games are, there's a black hole in your life there that just is, you can't get back. And people, you know, think it's such a glamorous life, and it's not necessarily when you're out on the road and you've got all these off days and you're waiting for another game to come along. So that played into it. But I would say that, you know, COVID pushed me out the door when the last 2 years came.
Yeah.
So I think that our industry, the hockey industry, and our broadcast industry changed dramatically and may not change back because of what's happened in the last 18 to 20 months. And I thought, this is the window. This is the perfect time, because I wasn't going to be around for a long time. It was closer to the end than the beginning anyway. And thought, time is right. This is the time to step out of it, because I wasn't comfortable traveling when there was a pandemic on, and you know, going on airplanes and staying in hotels and that sort of thing. I'm still not. And I think the restrictions and the protocols, the way that we deal with things and the broadcast industry is changed, and it's probably changed forever. Like last season, as I watched games, I sent this text a few times to people that I know that work in the industry, and I knew that they weren't on site. They were in a studio somewhere calling the game off a monitor, and I would text them and say, you're way too good at this. You will never travel again.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who will never travel again. It is the way of the future, in my opinion. Probably wasn't going to affect me as much, but you know, the team that we talked about and that wonderful group of people that you get together might not necessarily be together anymore, because people can work remotely. And you know, you might have, and I've seen this go on with productions in the United States, where the production is on, you've got the announcers on site, but you've got a tape operator who's in Miami, and you've got an audio person who's in Los Angeles, and you know, that's the sort of thing. So there's different ways to do it. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's going to be different. And as I thought through that, I thought, this is the time. The time is right to let somebody else do it. So that's a long, convoluted way of saying that there were a number of different reasons.
But so how long do you think from that glimmer of, God, I may be finished, to Tuesday? How long do you think that was?
Oh, probably a year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just watch what was going on in our world. Not just our world, but the world that I was working in. And I also knew that I was never going to be that guy that had to hang on for years and years and years and years. I just knew that, and that's not just a year ago. That's a long time ago. I knew that there was a finite time. I watched guys like Danny Galavan and Jim Robson leave the industry at the top of their game. And I thought, always thought, you know, I will know when it's time and I will leave on my terms. And in this decision, I get both.
You probably can't answer this question completely or 100% honestly, but absent the pandemic, do you think you'd be where you are today? Do you think you would be retired?
I think I'd probably be a year away from it. It was coming anyway. So I had sort of targeted a, not necessarily targeted a time, but yeah, in some ways I had, and had been working towards setting up our family's life so that it could happen. I could make that decision. It just hastened it a little bit, what's happened in our world. But no, Bob, I wasn't, this didn't cut 10 years off my career, maybe a year.
What was it like for you calling games off a monitor? I assume something you had not done, at least not with any regularity, prior to the pandemic.
I didn't do many off the, because during the pandemic, I chose not to travel. Mm-hmm. And the Rogers chose to have people on site for national games, which would normally be my job. So I only worked live games out of Vancouver. So I didn't, during the pandemic, I did not call a game off a monitor.
Really?
And I've only done it like probably half a dozen times in my career. And a couple of the times, it was very early in my career, where we didn't have the facilities that you have now. So, you know, I had one 700-pound, 26-inch television, and that was it, you know, for a monitor. And now you can have so many different views and so many different ways of looking at things that I think it's much easier to do. And I wouldn't be daunted by that. I think it's very doable. I'm not being critical of the industry for going to that sort of model. I've watched what's gone on with the Blue Jays this summer in baseball, and I've seen, and if you sit back and watch, for the most part, there's not many people that can tell me they know where the announcers are unless the announcers tell them where they are. Mm-hmm. And so it's a perfectly viable way to work in the industry. And I wouldn't say that has zero to do with me leaving. It's just a different way of doing things. So I can't answer your question because I've never really done it under the circumstances that are happening now.
How much did you enjoy doing baseball?
Loved it.
Yeah.
The only problem I've ever had with baseball is that they insist on playing the game every day all summer long. You know, so Canadian guy who's, you know, used to cold winters and beautiful summers. When I had to make a choice between the two sports, it didn't necessarily come down to the fact that I loved hockey more than I loved baseball. It came down to the fact that I'd rather work in the winter and have the summer off than the other way around. And as the time wore on, as you know, in the 80s and then into the 90s, the crossover seasons became unmanageable. Mm-hmm. So it made, you had to make a decision to do one or the other. I felt I had to. Some guys continued to do that, but it was really difficult because there were too many overlaps. But I absolutely love doing baseball.
So your first game for play-by-play, if memory serves me, was a Canuck game in Montreal, correct?
Yes.
And you have the score sheet, or do you have the wrong score sheet?
I had the wrong score sheet. So like, I don't keep meticulous records of anything.
No.
I don't keep all the, you know, the books and the things that that some people do. So I can't look back and tell you on this date I was here. I have no clue. I always looked ahead instead of looking back, except, you know, to look at the last game and be critical of it or whatever. So I thought that my first game was in October of 1979 at the Montreal Forum. And so Jason Murdoch, who's been a statistician who sat beside me for years at Hockey Night in Canada, went through the trouble of getting to the National Hockey League and getting into their files. And he got and gave me this score sheet from what I thought was the first game I'd ever done. And it was a Vancouver-Montreal game, and it was October of 1979. And so a couple of months later, I'm having a conversation with Jim Robson, who I had filled in for in those days. And I told him, I got this score sheet from the first game that I ever did. And he said, which one was that? And I told him the date. And he came right back to me and said, no, that wasn't your first game. Because he is meticulous in keeping notes in all of the files. And he said, no, the first game that I missed was in December of 1979. And you're right, it was Vancouver and it was Montreal. And I actually had the score right, because I think the score was the same in both of the games. But and Montreal always won in those days. So he corrected. And then Jason went back to the NHL and got me the score sheet from the actual first game that I had done. And when I looked at it, it was handwritten. Mm. It's really cool to look at it. It was, you know, the referees have signed it. Everything is done in ink. And that was another thing that I looked at. And I've said this a few times in the last few days when I looked at that and thought, that was 42 years ago. Uncle!
Yeah. And so what was so just out of curiosity, what was your last game?
Last game was a titanic struggle between the Vancouver Canucks and the Ottawa Senators in Vancouver sometime in the past March, when they were both completely eliminated from it. And there was nobody in the building. So it won't be that memorable game, except I got a chance to work again with John Garrett, who's a really good friend and a fun guy to work with. And we had a good night. So I had no idea at that point that it was the last game I would ever do. But if that's it, I will never remember that game either. And I won't keep the game sheet.
I was going to say, I'll send you the game sheet, Jimmy. Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, take your time.
My babysitting services of John Shannon have extended to a great variety of places, not the least of which was 2010 in Vancouver for the Olympic Games.
Oh yeah.
And I'm going to guess, as a BC guy, a guy who now your principal place is still in White Rock.
Yes.
So that, you know, right down the
beach, to be correct.
Okay. Right down the road from Vancouver. I'm guessing that was pretty special in terms of where you would rank the various events during your career. Yes, no?
Yes, but I didn't get to work. I was disappointed because the rights were all at a different place. So I knew that I wasn't going to get to work. And I thought, geez, you know, as a Vancouver guy, I was so proud of the way that things came together there. And I really, really would have liked to have worked. But I knew well in advance that I wasn't working for any network that was going to have any rights there. So I thought, I'm going to immerse myself in these games. I'm going to have this time off. I'm going to be in my city. I'm going to watch what goes on here. And I'm going to, you know, so I applied for all of those ticket packages. I went into the lottery I didn't care how much I spent. I had spent my retirement money on tickets, and I got nothing. I just lost the lottery. I got my son and I went up to watch ski jumping one day, so I shouldn't say I got nothing. And there was a couple of other events that I must say I gave the tickets away that I got. So I really lost out, but I did go downtown almost every day. And I would go into Molson Hockey House and watch the games there with so many other fans. And I'd walk down the streets and just enjoy the fact that the games were an absolutely fabulous success. And I don't get too maudlin about things like that, but it was a very proud time. It was cool to see what was going on in our city.
Well, and I've confessed my memory is zero, but Shannon will remember this. We were at Molson Hockey House.
Sure, Jimmy was there with us.
I was on the show with you.
He came on.
Exactly what I was going to say. You know, I'd love to tell you I remember, Jim, but
it's all right. But you did do Olympics. You did Sochi. Yes. Memory serves me. You did Torino. Did you do Torino? Did Torino. So can you compare an Olympics to a Stanley Cup final?
Yes, in some ways. I mean, there's nothing like knowing when you're broadcasting a game. Like, you know, when you do the Stanley Cup final, you know, when you sit down in that chair, that there are millions of people across the country that are riveted to it, that are excited about it. And you have to share in that excitement. It's just a little different when you know that the country is so patriotic that everybody who's watching you is cheering for the same team. That's very different. And so even in Sochi, because of the time difference, I was well aware of what people were doing. But they were getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. The bars were opening at 4 and 4:30 and 5 o'clock so that people could gather together to watch the game. And that was not lost on me. And then the other thing about that was in Sochi, the Team Canada is the best team I've ever watched play the game of hockey, bar none. They were the most efficient, the highest level. Even though some of their games were very close, there was never a doubt in my mind that team was going to win. It was so good. There are other teams of Team Canada that have won, and then we know the excitement of 2010 and that sort of thing. But that team was so proficient in Sochi that it was just spectacular to watch. So yeah, it's a little bit different when you like for me, there's every game that I've done, I've always felt National Hockey League games. I've always felt there's two teams in the game. It's just the way I'm trained, the way I'm wired. There's two teams in the game tonight. When you got Team Canada playing Belarus, I'm sorry, I can wrap myself in the flag for a moment, and did, and was very proud to do it.
I got one more question. You got something else, Shannon, you want to throw in?
I hate to tell you, but we could probably talk for 4 hours.
Well, I know we could. We could do that even if Huey wasn't quitting.
Yeah.
actually, before Bob's last question, one of the amazing things to me, and I'm a BC boy, is that the Vancouver Canucks joined the National Hockey League in 1970. And Jim is part of an amazing small club. And I want to know if it's in the water. How come there was only three TV play-by-play guys in the history of the Vancouver Canucks? When you think about Robson, Hewson, Shorthouse, who I think is a brilliant play-by-play guy in his own right, how did it happen in Vancouver that just there's three of you over 50 years, Jim? 50 years. It's amazing.
It all goes back to Robson. Jim Robson was there long before the Vancouver Canucks were in the National Hockey League, and he'd already established himself as a tremendous play-by-play man with the Western Hockey League team and on a number of other sports as well, in baseball and basketball and things like that. So he just came into the job and set the bar really high. So for young people like me and for John Shorthouse, he probably didn't spend as many years listening and watching Jim Robson as I did, but he too was affected by that. There was a bar that was set there that you had to attain. You couldn't go in and replace Jim Robson and change the way things were done very much, or it really would have upset a huge audience. And one of the things that went with that was it wasn't just a television audience, because there wasn't as much television then. But because of the time zone, the Vancouver radio market was probably the biggest hockey radio market in the National Hockey League, bar none, because you had a captive audience in drive time at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for so many of the games. And there were more people listening to games on the radio in Vancouver than were watching in New York for a Ranger game. That's a fact. That's just the way it was. So it was a very prestigious job, made so by an amazing person who set a bar that was very high. And I think that's the reason that's the reason I went back to that job in 1994 when I had an opportunity living in the East to go back to Vancouver, because people said to me, "You're going back to do radio in Vancouver?" I said, "Yeah, you don't know what that job is, but it's a very prestigious job that I'm very proud to do." So that's the explanation for why few people have done it and for why it's been done very well.
So we are basically day two of your retirement. Have you talked to a publisher yet? Have you got a book in you?
Not a chance.
No.
If I write a book, it's going to be fiction. And that's because that's what I love to read. I don't think anybody wants to read anything about me.
You'd be surprised.
And there's too many stories I don't want to tell.
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, you know, you have lived a unique life. There are very few that have the opportunity that you have had, respectfully, and have done it so well. 42 years in the business. I know a lot of people would like to hear your story. So, but then again, retirement does funny things to you. Like,
well, you could always go into
start
acting.
Working again.
I could go back. I could, you know, I can go back into the animal sports movie business because I cornered that market for a while.
Good.
Did you see Most Valuable Primate?
Not a chance.
Then you missed my performance with Dave Thomas when a monkey won the Stanley Cup. Have you seen the Air Bud shows?
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
I was in Air Bud.
So what you're saying is you're not retired. Make up your mind, Houston, will you, for God's sake?
Or just said I retired from hockey broadcasting.
Oh, all right.
And so, you know, it was probably more appropriate what you said at the start of this this spiel that we've been on here, that because I told the publicists and the people in the departments that deal with this sort of thing that I don't really want to use the R word, the retirement word, but you can say that I'm retiring from hockey broadcast. I would agree with you. I just quit.
Attaboy.
And I might do something else. And if there's some more animal sports movies, I might be in them.
Or another video game, because you're the voice of video games for how many generations? Two?
Yeah, it was that was a long, tedious run. We could go on for hours about that too. But yeah, EA Sports gave me an opportunity to do well because they're based in Vancouver at the time, and I think that's why I got the job. But it worked out pretty well too.
How many different ways can you say he shoots, he scores, right?
Oh, I found about 100 because we had to do that. This is brief, but that's the most tedious work I've ever done. You would sit for hours upon hours upon hours in a phone booth sized studio in a basement in Burnaby, BC, trying to recreate hockey games in snippets of little lines that would all be stitched together in a game. And I would finally, at the end of the day, I would say, I'm sorry, my voice is gone. My head is exploding. Our day is finished. So I love the finished product, and it was so cool to be a part of. But, man, that's as hard a work as I've ever done.
Well, listen, we're going to let you go and get on with your retirement. We thank you not only for the last...
I retire, I quit.
Yeah, that's right. You're quitting. well, I called you a quitter at the beginning of the program. You took issue with it, but now you've kind of adopted the phrase. Thank you for countless evenings of entertainment and in watching and listening to you, and more importantly, thank you for being a part of this program, both in the days before we got retired.
Yeah.
And
we didn't quit.
I can tell you Mondays with McCallan were one of my favorite parts of the week.
Well, you're a gentleman and you're a liar too, but we love you and we wish you nothing but the best, and hopefully we'll get a golf game at some point in time. And also hopefully we'll still be able to call you now and again and have a little chat. Thank you, Huey. Sincerely.
You're most welcome. This has been a real pleasure to be with both of you.
Jim Houston. We'll come back after these messages. McCowan and Shannon back with you to wrap it up. And we don't have a lot of time because Huey wouldn't shut up.
For a guy who doesn't want to broadcast anymore, he liked broadcasting. That's good.
Well, and we are the beneficiaries, and the audience are the beneficiaries of that, because I think even I learned a lot of stuff about him. I want to quickly talk about the Baruch Kiermaier thing. I never have I seen so much about so little as this incident, as if this is the most Titanic like thing that's ever happened in the sport of baseball. It happens not every day, maybe not every week, but sure as hell every month. And it happens over and over and over again. And people, please stop yammering about this and the significance of it. It means absolutely nothing. What Kiermaier said is gobbledygook, whether Baruch threw at him or didn't. And of course he did. is what you do in baseball. It's exactly what you do. And we all knew it was coming. And the rest of it is just nothing but BS. So shut up and forget about it. Thank you. That's all I have to say.
And here's the thing. If it helps the rivalry, if it makes it more intense, fantastic. That's it. That's it, Bob. You know, I'm not, I mean, here's the problem. I mean, if we had social media when Juan Marichal went with a baseball bat, what do you think would happen?
Well, I mean, okay, but Juan Marichal was 40, 50 years ago. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. I mean, rivalries and hatred in sports. We need more of it. We need more of it. We're too homogenized now.
Getting bent out of shape over this is nonsense. I mean, Blue Jay fans expected Kiermaier to pick up that piece of paper and walk over to the Blue Jay dugout and go to Alejandro Kirk and say, "Here, you drop this." Like, really? Seriously? You really think that's what he should have done or what he would have done? No. He grabbed it. He slithered back into the dugout, slipped it to one of the coaches. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Get to the photocopier and then give it back.
And then there's a big to-do about it. And then Baraki drills him in the numbers, which is exactly what Juan Marichal would have done.
Sure.
And exactly what I would have done.
Sure.
But that's part of the game.
This is
not newsworthy in any way. This is just a bunch of people who want to see themselves or hear themselves talk about it. Shut up and go away, which is exactly what we're going to do. We'll see you tomorrow.